Welcome to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. In each episode, Andrew interviews industry leaders. We'll hear their real-time opinions on today's market, their background and unique career highlights, and guidance for newcomers into the industry. You can find this show at spilarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Now here's the host of Real Talk, Andrew Kirsch.
Episode 29 of Real Talk. A lot of people ask me, who are these clients that are doing deals in today's market? Well, on this episode, I have Todd Hansen, the managing director of RM Communities, which is the GP platform of Realty Mogul, known as one of the top real estate crowdfunding sites. And so Todd will explain how they have been very active in this year. Now, RM Communities, as Todd will explain, is different from Realty Mogul. It's the GP platform, the operator sponsor division of Realty Mogul, and they obtain LP equity through the Realty Mogul investors or through third-party providers of equity. Now, what RM Communities does, which is different than most real estate owner operators, is they're real estate people who leverage technology, not the other way around, and they use algorithms to help them select locations to transact in. So you'll hear from Todd the types of markets that they are focusing on, the types of deals that they're focusing on, and they have been one of our more active clients in a market where there hasn't been a lot of activity. I think you'll find this conversation quite interesting.
Hello. Welcome to another edition of Real Talk. I'm here with my good friend, Todd Hansen, the managing director of RM Communities, the direct acquisition vehicle of Realty Mogul. That's a handful. Todd, how you doing?
Great. It's an honor to be here, Andrew. Thank you for inviting me.
Appreciate it. And you're dressed up in a jacket. I'm in a sort of a golf shirt, my panda. Oh, here we go. My panda golf shirt from my panda client golf tournament. So Todd, thanks. You probably give me more feedback on my show. So I guess that's what happens. If somebody gives me feedback, then they can be on my show. It's that low of a bar. No, just kidding. Todd, why don't you for our audience sort of describe what RM Communities is compared to the sister company of Realty Mogul, which may be more well known in the marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. So Realty Mogul is our parent company. Realty Mogul is a more traditional two-sided marketplace that was created in part as a result of the Jobs Act, where we're connecting sponsors with accredited investors. That's kind of the history of Realty Mogul, which is providing really high quality institutional real estate investment opportunities for credit investors who want to take a more active approach to their real estate private investing. About 3-4 years ago, we sort of looked at what we'd been doing within Realty Mogul and realized how, we had a great playbook for what had been working, seen sort of asset types that really resonated with a lot of our investors, and decided to create our own in-house direct investment vehicle, which is RM Communities. So RM Communities is a broad platform for direct investment into real estate, leveraging all of the infrastructure that Realty Mogul has. So we've got a huge investor relations infrastructure, legal, marketing, all these different things, all these different touch points, as well as almost 275,000 members that have become, intimately familiar with Realty Mogul. We tap into that, investing on our own accord, separate and apart from Realty Mogul, but leverage that really strong infrastructure and all that institutional knowledge that Realty Mogul has built over the last 10 years to allow us to be a little bit more laser focused and a little more data driven in how we invest. Right now, we're focused primarily on commercial residential, so multifamily, student housing, active adult, single family rental. But the goal ultimately is to expand the platform into other food group verticals. That's probably longer term plan for the time. There's plenty of opportunities for us to play just within residential with a particular focus on multifamily.
So thanks for that background. I mean, so if I can analogize it or just, you know, have a conversation over, you know, other equity providers, whether it's, you know, institutional private equity or family office that provides LP capital, who that's, you know, that's what they do. And, you know, they haven't made a conscious decision for the most part. I think maybe some of them will also buy direct as well as provide LP, but for the most part, you know, they're providing LP capital. So what was the impetus of, you know, going direct, being able to buy direct, operate, be a sponsor, and how was it administratively in terms of, I would imagine, hiring a lot more people in order to be a direct owner operator of real estate as opposed to an equity provider?
Yeah, it wasn't something we did half-hearted. I mean, I think a lot of planning went into it. But I think we came with the education of having worked with a ton of really sophisticated sponsors on the platform and really understanding what worked, what resonated with investors. So our goal was to, you know, create an alternative, not necessarily a competitor to a lot of those sponsors on the Realty Mogul platform, but an alternative that could build a brand, leverage a lot of the infrastructure, a lot of the best practices that we'd learned over the years working with some phenomenal sponsors, and try to build out something that we could do proprietary, have a little more control, directly controlling the real estate, a little more control over the timing, being able to be more proactive. We don't have any funds right now, so each asset stands on its own. So we're not working on sort of trying to diversify people across a fund. We're individually offering people opportunities that's going to match their specific investment criteria and provide a ton of information. We do quarterly webinars. We do a lot of touch points. I speak to a lot of our investors on a regular basis to understand what's their objectives right now, what sort of investments are going to meet their criteria to help them achieve their long-term wealth accumulation goals.
Is there any, I don't know if it's, or feedback, I'll say, is there any feedback from on the Realty Mogul side and the sponsors who Realty Mogul capitalizes? Are there any concerns from those sponsors saying, hey, now I'm competing with an RM Communities asset? Maybe I'm competing with them in the marketplace for a deal, or I'm competing with them even on Realty Mogul's platform, where there's, you know, a certain amount of investors and a certain amount of capital, and now RM Communities is going after those perhaps same investors as the sponsors that Realty Mogul is trying to capitalize.
Yeah, it's a great question. Something we're super sensitive, right? We want to protect the golden goose and not do any damage to our reputation and that trust that a lot of sponsors put in us. So one, you know, first and foremost, there's firewalls and all of the protections so that, you know, while we have access to a lot of data and we're very data driven at RM Communities, we're not seeing any of that proprietary information that sponsors are sharing with the folks that operate on our platform. And that's critical. We need those sponsors to be able to trust us and know that that information is going to be protected and not being used to compete against them. That said, we do have the ability to aggregate data and a lot of that data on an aggregate basis, even seeing things like seeing transactions on an aggregated basis 2-3 months before they close helps us see a little bit further into the future of trends that are happening, where transactions are occurring, where they're not. The other piece to that is, look, I hope someday that we can become a behemoth that other folks are saying, boy, I'm competing with, you know, RM Communities. Right now we're small enough. I mean, we've got a portfolio of 16 assets, 2,100 units, about $350 million of investments. We're not moving the needle in the markets that we play in. So the sponsors that are on our platform aren't viewing us as a competitor that's changing the dynamic of how they're able to execute on their business plans. And the other thing is, look, there's a lot of demand for really strong investments in private real estate. So if a sponsor brings us a deal, there's going to be capital for them. We're not competing over a smaller pie. The shortage right now is really good deals that make sense. We've got plenty of capital available on our platform and elsewhere for good deals from good sponsors.
Yeah, that all makes sense and definitely sensible on the explanation. You guys, compared to my client base, obviously we've been in a slower market for 10, 12 months, but I do feel that there has been a noticeable change in the last 30 to 45, maybe 60 days. And I feel like you guys are one of the more active, at least with respect to our firm, one of the more active players. What is your sense of the market and why is it, or how is it that you've been more active when others have not been able to transact?
Yeah, look, I think we pride ourselves on being a little bit contrarian, a little bit value oriented in the way we kind of approach investing. And, last year we made a decision as a team that things were just feeling a little too frothy. So we didn't acquire a single deal the last 9 months of last year. We were looking at lots of deals, but just nothing made sense. And we felt like there'd be better opportunities in the future. And so we sort of saved some of that powder, kept our finger really tight on the pulse of the market. And then when opportunities started presenting themselves this year, we sort of pounced on it, where we were seeing deals at 20% discounts to what that same transaction was going for last year. You know, we felt good about basis, we felt good about where we were. And as long as we were able to put onto those deals or capitalize them with debt that either was in place and we could assume, or debt we could go out and find in the market that made sense and gave us sufficient runway to get through whatever sort of short or medium term hiccups we see in the economy, we felt really good about acquiring at those types of pricings. So we've been much more acquisitive in the last several months and feel like this is a great year. There's probably more opportunities ahead of us, but we're just trying to be opportunistic. And last year, it was really tough. You know, Andrew, when you're in a transaction-driven environment and people are incentivized to close deals, it's difficult to sit on your hands or to pass on deals and not push. But when you trust your gut and you have the right incentives in place on the acquisition team to only do good deals, not do good deals just for the sake of generating fees, then I think in the long game, that pays off really well. And so far this year, it's paid off. We feel really good about the deals we've tied up and closed on, and feel really good that we weren't buying at the top of the market last year.
Yeah. Are you sensing that seller that I guess if you could go into as to how you've been able to transact over the last few months and why these opportunities have been available, is it because sellers are getting that much closer to a maturity date on their loan, and they know there's not a great exit for them with respect to refinancing? Are they getting closer to a rate cap expiring and they don't want to pay that seven-figure rate cap extension price? Or is it something else that is sort of we're sensing in the market that is causing more, not a ton of transactions, but more now than there was in the first quarter and certainly the last part of 22?
Yeah, a little bit more capitulation in the market. We try not to tell sellers we're going to use Sklar Kirsch until we have the deal tied up. Otherwise, that's a little intimidating, knowing how aggressive you are. No,
that's good. That's bad for my brand, Todd.
Very extremely commercial. Everything the perception is commercial. And Andrew, that's actually why we love working with you. Is you're very good at cutting through and focusing on the business issues. You are a businessman's attorney. And we're very efficient. Once we get a deal tied up, from getting awarded a deal to getting it executed is very efficient. We don't spend a lot of time having over points that are sort of theoretical in nature. So I kid. But no, really, it's we've identified a couple of areas where there's more opportunities that are sort of shaking loose in this environment. One is a lot of developers who are merchant builders don't have the ability to stay on a construction loan or converting to a perm loan. So we've been working with some developers who are looking to exit on stabilization or even during lease up. We've got some deep relationships there that we're leveraging where we can help them with the solution, that certainty of exit on stabilization or even certificate of occupancy. So developers is one area where we're seeing more deals shake loose, particularly merchant builders. And then the other piece is, you know, those value add buyers who have floating rate, bridge financing. They see what's coming, this sort of cliff where they've got to re-up on a rate cap, or they have a refinancing or an extension that's going to be difficult to achieve, and getting out ahead of those. Oftentimes they're deals we looked at and competed for, but maybe weren't awarded the deal, we weren't able to stretch for it. Going back to those deals and finding sponsors who are trying to find a constructive way to maybe return their investors' capital, avoid a capital call, or playing out an option that they know isn't going to be beneficial to their investors. So those types of deals are the other ones where we're finding real opportunities where we can come in, we can be flexible on timing of closing, we bring other flexibility to the table. We've offered sellers ability to roll into our deal, to recapitalize, to provide sort of runway capital. So by being flexible and targeting the right deals, I think we're just finding a few more things that are shaking loose. But there's still some pretty big bid-ask gaps in a lot of the markets, and we're still not seeing that full capitulation from sellers.
What's your view on rent growth? You know, those that have bought post-COVID in areas, in the Sun Belt areas, in Florida, in the Carolinas, Nashville, Texas, Phoenix, Vegas, you know, they were all just gaga over double-digit rent growth. Are what type of rent growth, or what, or maybe flat or decline, are you seeing? And I guess it's more specific in terms of the markets that you guys are pursuing.
Yeah. So, yeah, look, we had an unprecedented run in rent growth for a couple of years there, and it, you know, kept feeling unsustainable, but it happened for a while, and there were a bunch of reasons why: the household formation, the lack of new supply, a lot of things happened in that sort of post-COVID window that drove some things that we knew weren't sustainable, both from an affordability standpoint. Rents outpaced income growth, so renters just weren't able to afford that rent growth. You can't have 14% rent growth for any significant a period of time before you just outpace incomes and you price people out of renting at your property. So what we've tried to do is, you know, look, I think your question was, what are we modeling for rent growth? Completely property specific, right? What I'm modeling today in Austin, Texas is very different than what I'm modeling in Columbus, Ohio, or Madison, Wisconsin. And that's the beauty of our approach. We kind of have this barbell approach where we target two types of properties: sort of value add and higher growth markets like the Sun Belt, and then more core plus properties in markets like the Midwest. And right now the Midwest makes a lot more sense to us. Those cap rates are higher starting with. They're a lot less volatile, sort of low beta markets where you haven't had seen nearly the same amount of new supply coming into those markets. So we still think there's some of the best submarkets in some of those Midwest or sort of more slow and steady markets. We still think there's 2-4% rent growth for the foreseeable future. We're obviously modeling downside scenarios to make sure what it looks like in a down case, but we think that's achievable. Some of these markets that are inundated with supply, like Phoenix, Vegas, certain submarkets in Austin or Dallas, there I think we're modeling more like flat rent growth and some real hits to occupancy. There's just so much new supply coming on in some of those markets. And that's the problem, right? Developers see 14%, 20% rent growth, and they go to those markets, and just the nature of the developer mentality, that glass is not half full, it's overflowing. That's what the mentality you have to have to be a developer. I think a lot of those markets get overbuilt, and that's just part of the natural real estate cycle. So we're targeting markets that don't have the same supply pressure and have been a little more slow and steady in their growth. And that means a lot of things. One, they're not getting that same pressure, but two, they're still affordable. And that's where a lot of households are forming in those markets. And that's where you still have room to push rents because it's affordable relative to household incomes in those markets.
Yeah. Now, how do you guys decide what markets to go into? Because a lot of, let me just take a step back. You know, most of my clients are based in Los Angeles, but they're doing deals throughout the country. But when I say throughout the country, I really mean everywhere except maybe the Midwest and the Northeast. So from the Pacific Northwest, the Rocky Mountains, Phoenix, Vegas, Texas, Florida, Carolinas, Atlanta, Nashville. That's probably the markets where we do 90% of our work outside of California. You're transacting in areas in Midwestern towns and other areas that are not as common with my other clients. Some clients will you know, use can factor of can I get there in a on a direct flight in 3 hours or less. Others will use other metrics, right? Other than my affordable housing clients, which seem to be agnostic as to location, and they will go really throughout the United States, I feel like you guys at RM Communities really truly go everywhere throughout the United States compared to my other clients who focus on those markets that I just told you. So what is it like, or why?
Yeah. Well, look, there's definitely the risk of running yourself too thin. And I think if you're trying to find deals in too many markets or markets where you don't have expertise and you're pioneering without true boots on the ground, I think is really risky. So while it feels like we're looking in a lot of different places, we're very selective. Our directors of acquisition and myself, we're only focused on markets where we have real transaction experience, deep broker relationships, and ideally have already existing properties in that market. So we're actually seeing real time what's happening in those submarkets. We're trying to build around flags in around the country in markets we think have long-term sustainable growth properties. That said, you know, we have a flexible mandate. We can go to a lot of different markets. I think 10 years ago, or before that in real estate, there were some real opportunities in secondary tertiary markets. A lot of capital coming out of places like New York didn't want to go to a market that it took a connecting flight to get to, or you had to rent a car and drive an hour from a major airport. Nowadays, there's just so much information out there. Pick your data source provider. You can desktop underwrite a deal pretty cleanly from your seat in wherever you are in the country. And you don't need to be living and breathing in particular submarkets. So I think that informational advantage of living and breathing in a market has narrowed a little bit, but there's still a disconnect. And I think there's some real inefficiencies in the market if you're a rifleman, that you go out and find those markets where maybe it's underappreciated or it's not as sexy. And we think over time, a lot of those secondary and tertiary markets that aren't as sexy, that gap narrows between. Look, you go to your country club dinner and it's a lot more fun to talk about an investment that you're building in Miami than it is to talk about a deal in Detroit, Michigan. It's just not as sexy. As much as I love Detroit, I think it's a great market. I think there's some great things going on there with sort of the revitalization of automotive and manufacturing. But it's just more fun. And that if that results in a pricing disconnect that's irrational, then we think the opportunity is better in Detroit. And there are certain times in the market cycle where that's the case. No different than it's very sexy to invest in NVIDIA right now in the stock market. But I'm not sure that that's the best value. They're smaller. If you're willing to look at small and mid caps, look in other sort of less sexy industries, I think there's probably just as much opportunity investing in the stock market than investing in those glamour, you know, big seven FANG type names. And we think it's the same when it comes to investing in markets, as long as you're not spreading yourself too thin or going to markets where you don't have enough institutional knowledge to be effective.
Yeah. Not sure if there's anything sexy about the country club dinner world, but
I wouldn't know. I'm not invited to it.
Maybe people bragging about their average golf games and they think that's sexy. So, which mine is average and sometimes below average. Let's talk about the capital side. Of the business. Mm-hmm. First the debt, and then we'll get into the equity. How are the debt markets for you with the types of deals you are pursuing, especially a deal like you were talking about where a merchant builder is looking to get out and perhaps there's a lease up play. You know, what are the debt what's the debt that's available for that type of transaction?
Yeah. And look, there's no secret. The debt markets right now are difficult. We're lucky to be focused on multifamily and that we've got, you know, the agencies that are that kind of lender of last resort and what makes multifamily so much easier to invest through cycles in than some of the other real estate food groups. It's still a favored asset class. So there's still capital chasing it throughout the capital stack, but it is much more expensive to borrow today, no doubt. And, you know, our mission is to find deals where we think we're avoiding ideally negative leverage, meaning your cost of debt is higher than your going in cap rate. But that's difficult in these environments. So
yeah, is that really even careful. Obtainable?
I think it is. But, you know, for me, it's always like going in cap rate is sort of this obscure concept. It's really about what is my year one or what's a stabilized number. So can I, how quickly can I get to positive leverage is much more the focus than going in. If I'm going in, but by the thinnest of margin and I'm not taking it anywhere, then having positive leverage was just sort of a, you know, this artificial thing where I check the box. It's really about where am I getting to and how quickly can I produce sort of positive leverage and take advantage of my debt. At the same time, look, I think while we do think rates are higher for longer, I think we do think that we're probably in the end of a hiking cycle and we'll probably get some relief on rates in the medium term. Probably not in the next couple of months. Certainly, we probably have a couple hike or two left from the Fed from everything they're telling us. And if you look at the dot plot, but I think what that means is we want to put capital, debt capital on our deals that gives us flexibility. We don't want to tie up fixed money for 10 years at this point in the cycle. Historically, that's been the wrong time to put long-term fixed rate debt. If you look historically, when the Fed's nearing the end of a rate hike cycle, being a little bit more flexible, shortening up your duration on your debt, maybe even thinking about floating rate debt, while it hurts in the moment, historically, that's been the best move. So we're trying to be really creative, create a lot of optionality, make sure we have time on our debt to execute our business plan, but have as much optionality as possible so we're not facing big yield maintenance or defeasance payments on long-term fixed rate debt, which can get you into trouble at this point in the cycle.
So are you going to the agencies, you going to banks, you going to debt funds, you going to all of them for the various opportunities that you're seeing?
Yeah, all of the above, for sure. I mean, we're trying to canvas the market and it really is deal specific. So what I'd put on a brand new construction, fully stabilized deal that doesn't have a ton of value add upside, that debt capital structure is going to probably be different than a value add deal that's a heavy lift and we may have a hit to occupancy in the short term. And we've got a big CapEx budget. We'd rather a lender finance than refinance with equity. So really depends. I will tell you that the vast majority of our existing portfolio, I mean, we felt like rates were headed up. So the last several years we've been using, as you know, almost exclusively agency long-term fixed rate debt. So we've got some deals with, you know, 2%, right around 2%, full term IO, 10-year money with the agencies. And the best part about that deal at this point is the debt we put on it. It's extremely attractive asset if we were trying to sell that asset. And it's helping us generate really outsized cash flows on those deals. It's been great for the investors that participated with us in those deals. Now we're trying to be a little more nimble. So we're looking at kind of everything. The bridge debt's been difficult. Obviously, anything from the regional banks, since all the activity with SVB and other banks the last couple of quarters, we've seen a lot less bids from regional banks. That becomes even more relationship driven than it was historically. But we're trying to be as broad as possible and match the debt to the specific business plan, a specific deal, and sort of offsetting that with preserving as much flexibility as we can. Because I think there's going to be some pretty dynamic shifts in the next, call it year and a half, in the capital markets on the debt side.
Yeah. And what's your ideal hold period?
Yeah. You know, I would say that the typical RM Communities investor is looking for a longer hold, call it 5 to 7 years. We typically aren't doing a 3-year quick flip business plan. That's kept us out of trouble. Certainly glad that, you know, at this point, we don't have a bunch of those deals in our portfolio. Those can be very lucrative, but so much of your returns on those 3-year deals is driven by a quick exit. And so much of that IRR gets eroded if you extend the business plan. We like a deal that isn't reliant on a quick flip because we have more flexibility. If we opportunistically have the opportunity to sell earlier in a hold, we can do that. We have that flexibility. But I'd rather start with a slightly longer business plan and hold period and move that in rather than feel like we're under the gun to execute on a business plan where the slightest hiccup throws us off and starts really eating into those returns that we committed to investors.
Yeah. So let's talk about the equity side of RM Communities. So are your investors the same? And I think we talked about this at the outset, the similar profile of investors that Realty Mogul taps into on the LP side of the ledger?
Yeah, so absolutely. That's a big part of what we try to do. So our mandate in-house is, you know, we can raise our equity capital wherever we want to. that's been kind of four different places historically. A big part of it is in almost every deal we do, we will take a portion of the equity, the LP equity, to our platform and raise it through Realty Mogul's platform. That's a really nice source. We've built a great rapport with a lot of repeat investors that know and understand what RM Community stands for, have interacted with us over the years and really trust us. It's been a really nice source of equity for us, and we really value those relationships. We've, of course, got the balance sheet that we can bring to deals. Our third source would be, you know, Realty Mogul has two REITs, an income REIT and a growth REIT, which really matches, coincidentally, very, very much so with our kind of barbell approach to investing. And we will oftentimes show our REITs, even though it's an arm's length transaction, we will show them investments, and they have found a lot of our opportunities really attractive and have chosen to invest in a lot of our deals. So having that REIT capital and the REIT's balance sheet, who can serve as a non-recourse carve-out guarantor on some of our debt, things like that. Those REITs, they've been a great partner for us. They're acting as fiduciaries for their own investors, but they still know what the relationship, value the relationship with us on an arm's length basis, and have been a big part of our capitalization historically. And then the fourth piece, is which I think is the piece where we're going to grow over time, is joint ventures. Bringing in other sponsors, other capital providers who like what we do, and maybe say, hey, we could each do a $20 million deal, or together we could go buy a $40 million deal. We pool our resources, pool our institutional knowledge, and go out and do that. We've been really successful in several markets, and we have some really good relationships. That's a place we'd like to grow. And probably the one thing I'd emphasize there is we built out a new program where we're trying to work with beginning sponsors who, you know, are still trying to build that track record, maybe don't have that access to significant amount of equity capital yet. They passed around the hat a few times to friends and family, and that starts to get tapped out pretty quickly. We can be a partner to some of those emerging sponsors where we can give them access to our platform investors. We can bring our own capital to bear, and we would JV that deal. It allows them to do bigger deals, tax their friends and family a little less, and still build up that track record and presence in markets they want to be. So we think that's a really attractive alternative to a lot of these new emerging sponsors that, you know, are sort of, you know, long term they'll be super successful, but in the time being, just attracting capital right now and being able to do bigger deals with scale, a partner like us who can do that in a really efficient way and is used to working with other sponsors, we think that's advantageous for both sides, mutually beneficial.
It sounds like you got all sides covered. You can be the GP. You can be a co-GP for an emerging sponsor.
Yeah.
You could partner up, I think I heard you correctly, with another sponsor and tap into their equity resources. Absolutely. Or you can go to the third party family office or private equity world and get more of a traditional joint venture structure to capitalize the equity.
Yeah, look, it's best player available. Where I was trying to figure out, where is capital available at the moment? You hate to wed yourself to one particular source of equity capital, because that can shift very quickly with the winds of change. So trying to be broad, we're picking our partners very, very, particularly ones who see the world the same way we do and have the same focus. But we like to have a diversified source of equity. And I think that's probably the growth engine, is more outside capital, less reliance on the platform, and probably fewer deals with our REITs going forward as they try to diversify their investments as well.
Yeah. I guess sort of final question on this topic, how has raising money been in today's market, whether it's through the platform of Realty Mogul or elsewhere? How's it been?
Yeah. Good deals attract capital. I mean, I don't think that changes, but, marginal deals or deals that don't have a good story, I think right now it's been tougher. When people see headlines about inflation, headlines about layoffs, I think a lot of equity sort of pulls back and wants to be on the sideline. I think we're fortunate that, look, multifamily has shown to be not recession proof, but recession resistant, that, people see headlines about the shortage of housing and, understand that, housing is a necessity. So investing in multifamily feels a lot safer than maybe a retail investment or other private real estate investment opportunities that might be out there. where we feel like we may be on the edge of a precipice of a recession. But it's, you know, I would tell you a year ago, two years ago, on our platform or on competitors' platform, I would say that the equity spigot was on. Almost any deal could put out returns, and a lot of deals were getting funded. And the real battle that our parent company, Realty Mogul, fought was being a gatekeeper to make sure that deals had proper investment protections and were prudently underwritten, so that only the sort of real credible opportunities got up available to investors. In this environment, it is tougher. You know, not only the number of deals that are just out there, there's fewer deals, which I guess works to our advantage, but just the quantum you can raise on a per deal basis. It's just a lot difficult. A lot of the more institutional capital has gone to the sidelines. We are seeing that in our markets, you know, in deals where typically the bidding tent had, call it 20 bids. We're now seeing 5-10 bids. We like that. You know, we love the fact where we can be one of the bigger fish in the bidding tent and maybe a smaller market. And if there's fewer institutional buyers, it just helps our standing. So it is a little more difficult, but we're still finding that really good deals will attract capital, particularly where there's a story and the deal feels opportunistic. I mean, data point, our marketing folks, you know, we have a really big marketing team institutionally. And they, you know, they look at SEO, search engine optimization, and what sort of keywords drive clicks or what is attractive. And anything that sounds like opportunistic or distressed in this point in the cycle is getting a ton of traction versus traditional bread and butter core plus, you know, is less interesting. People kind of yawn and swipe to the side, but it's a much more attractive investors, and a lot of credit investors or high net worth are looking for distressed or opportunistic investments that they think are either present or are coming.
Yeah. Well, that's, look, we're in interesting times, and the fact that you guys are nimble, where you can play in the capital stack, the types of capital that you can be attracted to, and want to partner with, will prove extremely valuable in order to bob and weave in the market. As a viewer and listener of our podcast, you know we're at the time of the world famous lightning round. Are you ready for the Real Talk lightning round, Todd?
It is world famous, and you're so good at like the shock value. It's, you never know what to expect.
Because I don't even know. So
for my first, poster.
Yeah. All right. Well, for those that are watching this, may see that I believe behind you is a Peloton. I saw sort of like I see the seat. I recognize it. We have to show it. Is it a Peloton?
Yes, sir.
All right. So I'm a big Peloton guy. So, first question, who's your go-to Peloton instructor?
Wow. That's a tough one. Probably Ali Love or Alex Toussaint are probably my favorites. Good
Both.
Music. I mean, you kind of lose yourself in a workout. I was one of the few people who held out all through COVID and didn't get a Peloton and just couldn't justify it. And then post COVID, you know, was like, you know what, I need another alternative, and my knees aren't getting any younger. These runs around the Palisades over by your place is getting harder and harder. So the Peloton's a nice break from distance running for me.
I know. It's funny, since I got the Peloton early during COVID, and it's just so convenient. And in a 20 or 30 minute ride, you're drenched, and good music and fun instructors to kick your ass.
So who's your favorite? That's
let's see. My go-tos are it's all about the music. It's 80s, it's 80s rock, it's 90s, it's 90s rock. That's my genres. So those that play that, Leanne Hainsley, her fiance or maybe husband, Ben Aldiz, I think, from London. Mm-hmm. Emma Lovewell.
She's great.
I also like Olivia Amato, and you can sort of see where
she's intense.
Yeah, you can sort of see where I'm headed. Kendall Toole and others. All right, let's get off Peloton.
It's going to get you in trouble.
It will. Hey, it's just on a screen. I you alluded to the technology of the company, and I'm fascinated. And in our sort of remaining time, what, I guess, being in a, I don't want to call you a non-traditional real estate company, but there's so much focus on technology. Yeah. What is it like being a real estate professional working in a company that has so much, you know, technology associated with it? Because in my typical day-to-day, most of my clients' typical day-to-day, what a long question, by the way, for a lightning round. You know, we typically don't interact with a lot of technology people, but you do. And so give us, in a lightning round type of answer, what is it like working in an environment that is centered around technology?
Look, Andrew, I think you're being modest. You're very tech forward. I remember when you first formed Sklar Hirsch and seeing you speak on panels and do podcasts where you talked about how technology forward you guys were and trying to create a better working environment for your attorneys. And we see that, how you guys have formed the firm. We're kind of the same way. And I'm certainly glad I'm not the tech expert or responsible for the technology component. But I remember when I was as a banker, many years back, and the Jobs Act came out and crowdfunding became a thing, and we started working with some of the sort of the dog fathers of crowdfunding, seeing groups like Peer Street and others that were forming, it was like, this seems like such a great marriage between technology and real estate, and real estate is sort of one of the laggards and the last adopters of technology. So this seems like a very ripe opportunity. Fast forward several years ago, get the opportunity to join Realty Mogul. I think where we would differentiate ourselves is we're real estate people in general that leverage technology, as opposed to some of our peers are technology sort of looking for a solution and trying to apply it to real estate. And so I think we come at everything with a real estate orientation and overlay of technology. I think that makes us a little different than a lot of our peers. Look, it's amazing how much work goes into making everything seamless for our investors. And how much technology supports that, and how we're constantly tweaking that to just make everything that they do in terms of the investing process, the watching your investments, any sort of updates that you need, including white glove service from our investor reps. All that stuff is very tech centric. But at the end of the day, we're providing real estate. RM Communities is focused on providing the best real estate solutions. Where I thought you were going, which is the other thing that technology impacts my day. So I work for a company that leverages technology, but at our properties, you know, I'm sure you've heard this, Andrew, I've listened to your podcast, you've talked about it. Costs are inflated across the board, and we are looking for technology solutions at our properties to really peel out costs. So where can we remove redundancies? Where can we take out some of the labor costs in an efficient way that our residents will enjoy? And provide those savings because, you know, we've seen a ton of pressure. We're actually seeing more pressure in some places on labor turnover or staff turnover than we are on unit turnover. And trying to moderate that cost through technology, you know, most of our renters and a lot of our properties are very tech savvy and they're very comfortable buying a car, heck, you know, buying a house, renting an apartment without actually interfacing with a real person, doing that all online, touring a property virtually. There's a lot of things we can do. So we're implementing some of those technology solutions along with some of the more ESG forward things like EV charging, even solar and things like that. We're looking at where can we maximize returns for our investors in a way that our residents appreciate and enjoy.
Yeah. I mean, are there any like one or two particular technologies that you feel move the needle significantly from an operational standpoint?
I think EV charging is one of them. You know, it's an easy one. And, you know, there's certain markets where I think we're not going to be the pioneer there. But I think if you look at where the government incentives are, if you look at where ICE engines are going and where EV is going, and you think about, heck, a third of the households in our country rent, at some point there will be a need to charge electric vehicles at multifamily properties. And it's few and far between. It. We're a little bit jaded because we live in Los Angeles, Andrew, but you know, you get outside the coast and a lot of markets, it's unheard of to see a multifamily property with EV charging stations. Understanding where the trends are going and trying to get ahead of that and differentiating yourself is a great opportunity to leverage, you know, nothing complicated technology-wise, but a little bit more tech forward, a little bit more ESG forward, and something that helps us retain residents or attract new residents in a way that's positive returns for our investors.
Yeah, well, I think even just talking about that sort of dovetails with everything you've said on this podcast, from how you look at deals, the locations, the types of capital, extremely flexible, forward thinking, maybe contrarian in some views. And it's what has made you guys successful, both on the Realty Mogul platform. And then of course, in the last few years with RM Communities, of being so active in a time where a lot of people haven't been. And I just want to congratulate you on all your success at RM Communities, and you've been a great friend and client, and love doing transactions with you, and I wish you all the success, and thanks for coming on to Real Talk.
Thank you, Andrew. It's been a pleasure. We so appreciate the relationship with you and your partners. You guys have been a tremendous asset for us in transactions, and know that we can count on you, and you're a go-to legal firm. So thank you for this opportunity, and thanks for being a great partner.
Appreciate it. And I hope to see you on the Peloton leaderboard on one of our rides.
We'll see. I'll take you up on that.
Perfect. All right, Todd, take care.
Thanks, Andrew. Nice chatting.
Bye.
You've been listening to Real Talk, Real Estate Discussions with Andrew Kirsch. You can catch prior episodes at scholarkirsch.com and on YouTube, LinkedIn, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Thank you for your positive reviews, comments, and for sharing the show with others.